Hey, this is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. You know, pessimism is everywhere these days. Three quarters of us, 76% of Americans, now tell Gallup that they are dissatisfied with the direction of the country. Who can blame us, right? COVID-19 has killed over a million Americans. There's a major land war going on in Europe with one of the combatants or belligerents being a nuclear power. The stock market is tanked. The political scene is filled with fakers and liars whose grasp on reality is weak at best, right? But Mark P. Mills, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and an engineering faculty fellow at Northwestern, makes a compelling case for optimism in The Cloud Revolution, how the convergence of new technologies will unleash the next economic boom and a roaring 2020s. I like the sound of that. Increasingly, he says, microprocessors, materials, and machines are being tied together through cloud computing to deliver startling, steady, and mostly underappreciated gains that are vastly improving all of our lives every day, but in ways we don't really acknowledge. The example of the iPhone, which debuted in 2007 and radically altered how we live, illustrates Mills's point. He says it basically utilized existing technologies, but tied them together in new ways. That sort of breakthrough is happening all around us, he says, creating innovation that is disruptive as hell in the short run, but ultimately positive in the long run, if we'll finally let go of centuries-old anxiety about change. This is a really good, upbeat interview episode. Mark P. Mills is fascinating. It's a great way to start 2023. This is going to be a better year than the last couple. Here's hoping, anyway. And here is The Reason Interview with Mark P. Mills. Mark P. Mills, thanks for talking to Reason.
It's a pleasure to join you.
Okay, so you wrote a book not too long ago, about a year ago, called The Cloud Revolution, How the Convergence of New Technologies Will Unleash the Next Economic Boom and a Roaring 2020s. And you start out that book, which I recommend to everyone, especially if you feel bad about the current moment in terms of tech or politics or culture, because this is a generally optimistic book, although not Panglossian or uncritical. But you start out by talking about the last roaring 20s in the 1920s, and you point out that decade, like this one, got off to a really bad start. What was going on in that roaring 20s, and why do you have, you know, such confidence that we're about to enter our own roaring 20s in the 21st century?
Yeah, you know, I appreciate that. I think the reason I started with the 1920s as an analog was twofold. Part was to context how one makes forecasts in general, especially about technology. Mm-hmm. So forecasting technology is different than forecasting politics. There's obviously relationships in these domains. I mean, I've worked in and still work in very varying degrees, sort of the three domains that determine the future of everything. Politics, policy matters enormously. As I write in my book, others have said, if you don't get the politics right, a famous Krauthammer quote, if you don't get the politics right, nothing else matters. That's true. Right. You can Sovietize an economy. The Soviets proved it. Venezuela's proved you can destroy economies. So I'm not naive about that. So you have to understand politics. It matters. You have to understand the economics of structures of businesses and economies. Because money always matters. One thing I learned as a physicist a long time ago is I always say, you know, follow the physics to know what you can't do. Okay? Mm-hmm. Follow the money to know also what you can or can't do. And then, of course, technology matters. What are innovators doing? What are inventors doing? What are physicists discovering, if you like? So they intersect each other. They play off each other. But you can't write a book about all three simultaneously. And I would say not understanding what the political forces are, then you can make very bad decisions. But similarly, politicians and forecasters make very bad decisions if they don't understand technology properly. And I would offer this idea that the one thing that does change, things that do change, things that don't change, human nature doesn't change. So that means politics don't change. There are patterns in it, but we go through periods of depression, overexuberance. We have potentates. We've always had them. Mm-hmm. Kleptocrats. These struggles are eternal. The fact that we can still read advice from the 1900s, from the 1500s, from the time of the Roman Empire that's still relevant today to politics and war fighting is because human nature hasn't changed. And this is true about money, by the way. How we move money has changed. You know, we don't drag mm-hmm. gold around in carts. We have crypto and digital exchanges and Zelle.
And we're not putting dollars in wheelbarrows just yet, which was part of Germany's roaring 20s,
right? It could happen at the current inflation. But the monetary policy is important. But I say those things because the thing that has changed the most, what's very different about our present than the past, any past, is technology. The biggest changes in the world are all technology related. Not the fact that we have wars or don't, we have peace or try, that we have love and hate, you know, all the things. There are cultural shifts, but no one would dispute the central fact that what made the biggest difference to what governments can do that is constructive is technology. So it's a long preamble to the point that what was interesting about the 1920s is it was a hell of an ugly time. People have forgotten. We just finished a pandemic that lasted 3 years at three waves. The 1918 flu killed far more people per capita by about 400% than the COVID did. It killed the young preferentially, which is grotesque, whereas the evil COVID killed the old preferentially. We went through a world war that was horrific in every respect, the first quote, Great War.
War to end all wars.
Yeah, we had race riots. Yeah. We had debate over the sexual revolution of that era, which was the emancipation of women to let them have the vote. It was a constitutional amendment, which was controversial at that time. We had the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. People worried about the Red Scare. We had yellow journalism, clickbait in today's parlance, of unprecedented proportions. We had invasions and attacks on free speech. So if you don't have to
read closing. I mean, in 1921 and then definitively in 1924, a closing of the borders America.
We had inflation, not inflation. We had inflation worries. We had immigration worries. Mm-hmm. What was really interesting about the early 1920s is that every single feature of what people are despondent about in our culture today, almost without exception, is echoed as occurring not only then, but contemporaneously then. And yet, the so-called Roaring Twenties took off. They took off culturally with the Jazz Age, the Great Gatsby, all the blossoming of the American culture that was positive at that time was somehow happened anyway, despite how depressed people were, say 1919, 1920. But also, what began then was a great coalescing of revolutions in technologies that were maturing and could mature contemporaneously. In the machine world, we had the advent but the proliferation of electrification, the proliferation of telephony, of automobiles, of air travel. We had the advent of the chemical industry in its sense, it's very positive, artificial materials, pharmaceuticals. All these domains of technology began to mature roughly in the 1920s. They were all invented, developed in the previous decade or two. But the fact that they all happened simultaneously in terms of a maturation and propelled the economy in ways that were unprecedented in history, led to the biggest economic boom in all of history. So the expansion of wealth, which is technology driven, technology drives wealth. Wealth requires a sensible rule of law, a predicate trading system that's regulated not too heavily, all those things. But the wealth is fundamentally driven by productivity, which is always, always, always technology driven. That confluence was really remarkable. And my contention in my book, and the reason I wrote the book, the reason I'm optimistic, is that we have an echo for the first time a century later, not just culturally. We have the same anxieties, the same battles. Culture is different, but fundamentally, the battles are the same. And for the first time in a century, we have the same confluence in technology maturation across the same kinds of domains. And when you're in the present of it, it's hard. You know, hindsight's great. You look back, we see these pivot points in history. Well, the pivot points are never exactly 1 year or exactly one technology or exactly one company, but we tend to write history around a person or an event or a company or a technology. You know, the invention of the light bulb, okay. But what that epitomized was the democratization of electrification. You know, the invention of the airplane. It didn't happen with the Wright brothers. I mean, there were lots of people before and after, but you use those icons. So what I did in my book, because it was my conviction and my research, is I looked at both the icons of what the technologies are today across many domains and whether or not they were at the point of a tipping point to maturation. So the key here is the future, the near future, is not what you invent today. The near future is created by what we invented earlier, last decade or two, that is today reaching a point of commercial viability. The car was invented in the late 19th century. So the tipping point, which occurred just before 1920, famously the Henry Ford's mass production, you know, the Model T, that was almost 30 years after the invention of the car. It took a few decades of fits and starts, lots of entrepreneurs, trials, money, you know, hype, over-enthusiasm. Same was true of the rail age, as we know. The giant, huge depression caused by the over-enthusiastic investing in both fraudulent and real rail lines in the early 1800s. Very famous stock market crash. Those characteristics are always there. But so here we are today with this, I think, efflorescence of technology, which could be ruined. I mean, let's just be clear. I'm not a Pollyanna. I don't think that governments couldn't ruin it or slow it down. I think we're slowing it down right now with our inappropriate, I'll call it inappropriate to be to be gentle, government approach to, quote, stimulating the economy. Or inappropriate approach of the Fed to tamp down inflation. I mean, the way to get rid of inflation is not to raise interest rates. I'll be simplistic. It's to increase the supply. I mean, if inflation is too much money chasing too few goods, how about let's stimulate more goods production? Whatever the goods are, the prices will go down. That long predicate gets you to where my
people are. And let's talk about that, because in the 20s it was a certain set of technologies that you were talking about that had been around for a while but reached kind of a mass population or a critical mass. Things like the automobile, things like kind of media and newspapers, radio, stuff like that.
Radio was all 1920s.
Yeah. So, and it's funny when, before we go on to what's happening now, I was just reading, every January 1st, a bunch of stuff comes into the public domain. And one of the books, one of the novels that came into the public domain just a couple of days ago was Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse, which, among other things, has these long screeds by the title character about how recorded music is evil and how listening to live symphonies over the radio is evil. You know, it's destroying that. You know, every decade of big changes, has these kinds of anxieties, which it's easier to feel those when you're in it and then to look back at them as kind of quaint. Why were they worried about comic books or rock and roll in the 50s or even TV, But the big thing, that is in your title of the book is the cloud. So talk about how the cloud, this floating, ethereal, supercomputer that is everywhere around us.
Yeah.
What is that? And how is that the thing that is really, that's where you're placing most of your bets, that the kind of maturation of cloud computing is as big as, kind of the invention of the personal computer and the internet itself. It's the next great thing. Talk about that.
Yeah, it is the thread. And that's why the title. And it's a thread because it's not a single invention. It's an infrastructure. And the arrival of new infrastructures is a rare thing in society. We only have a handful. You know, water is an infrastructure, power, roads. But you don't have to work very hard to come up with it's a rather short list of things that constitute infrastructures. And infrastructures have a unique feature to them. It's because why they're called infrastructures. They tend to affect a lot of things. They tend to facilitate a lot of opportunity, a lot of change by virtue of the fact that they are infrastructure, right? The infra means inside. They're not exogenous. They animate everything. It's like the skeletal structure, if you like, of a body. So the cloud, I think, is misunderstood, broadly speaking. And first, you have to sort of define what it is to know why it's different. As I write in my book, the cloud is as different from the internet as the internet was different from telephones. The first use of the internet used the telephone network. People of a certain age can remember dial-up modems.
I can hear the screeching of my, at a point of 9600 baud modem. Yeah, you know, that exactly. Was, boy, that was fast.
It was, yeah. Well, you know, we lived, and it physically used the infrastructure of telephones. So, but let me put it this way to make it simple in terms of why the cloud is not the internet. The internet was a way, to put it very simply, you could do, let's say, you got mail, the famous AOL, jingle, if you like. So we replaced a communication medium that was audio with the one that was visual and text. But it's essentially what was going on. If you went shopping on the internet in the early days, you could go to a website, but it was like looking at a catalog that was on your screen. You could order something. It was a big deal. Everybody's very excited about it. But it wasn't different in function than a catalog that was shipped to you and picking up the phone. It was easier, better, the same function. The same is true of computing itself. Computers did computing. They add things up, spreadsheets, so forth. Now, what the cloud does in the simplest way is it set aside its scale, just what it does. It's more of it does a lot of things. It's more of a advice giving infrastructure than it is a communications infrastructure. It uses communications, and it uses computers. But what you do with a cloud is best analogized with what people do with mapping, navigation. You know, when you ask for directions, you're not asking for a calculation. You're not asking for specific. You want to know, given the time of day, where you're physically located, which obviously the cloud knows because you volunteered that information with your GPS. But you want to know based on where you are, where you want to go, the time of the day, the kind of traffic, often the kind of weather, a recommendation of options of how to get to where you're going to go. You get options. You get advice. This is really different than a calculation. This would be true of a doctor who takes an x-ray of you or has information about you and looks for advice to combine with his advice about what the image shows, about what your diagnostic and what your physical conditions are. Advice giving is not computation. Inference is not the same as just adding up. So that functionality is profoundly different. Farmers have been using it for a long time. If you what seeds to plant based on where they're located, not only the trailing weather and the soil conditions, but the future weather, future market conditions, what prices have been and might be for certain kinds of wheat. You can ask advice. As that advice giving becomes more powerful, more intimately tied to more things, not just people, but sensors everywhere, ubiquitously available, which everybody knows is using the wireless communication network. And the power, of course, comes from the utility function of computing in the cloud that does more than, again, compute. It functions in images and graphics processing, not in just information processing.
Can I ask, am I getting it right when, kind of the way you're talking about it, we have moved beyond MapQuest, or say, in the early internet, you could look up a map.
Sure.
And you could say, okay, look, there's places to go. Then it was great when MapQuest came along and gave you, turn-by-turn directions that you could print out, and blow your entire budget on your inkjet printer, bring it with you, hopefully not miss, drop the pages so that it all gets mixed up. And now we have, you know, Google Navigator, or we won't mention Apple Maps, but, you know, but we have a program which gives you several different ways of getting to a place that also is mapping in real time traffic flows.
Correct.
So you can be like, well, this is the fastest route available.
And
you'll get there in a certain amount of time, or you can go here or there. These are, you know, these become different things once we can kind of take into account more and more information and get advice and then figure out what we want to do.
Well, also, the real-time part's important here because, as you know, when you're while you're driving, the maps update and tell you that something has happened. So we take this for granted, obviously, because it's so common. It becomes so ubiquitous, right? So we take for granted that kind of functionality, but it really is quite remarkable. If you think about, to your point, how we were amazed at having MapQuest, or rather than carrying around physical maps for most of history, that this functionality moved from a computer giving the map printing out to a computer figuring out routes to dynamically adjusting advice to you, not controlling you, but giving you advice. If you take that logic and apply it to any thing. Supply chains for a manufacturer. You're a small business. You want to know, you want to have some idea about what you should order, when you should order. What would be nice to have, so you don't have to guess what the supply chain is for the supply chain to be sufficiently censored and secure, hence things, the word that people misunderstand, the blockchain that allows secure information exchange and transactions about information, not money. You'd like to be able to ask a question about, should I order more of X or Y? When do I need it? You'd like the advice giving to be semantic. In other words, you don't have to be a programmer. So the semantic internet, you'd like it to be reactive to not only you personally in your circumstances, but to your business circumstances to do forecasting for you with advice. These things are sort of proliferation of things like that now in the form of apps. So the single most remarkable new product of the 21st century is the app. It's a tool. Its word tells you what the tool is. It's an application specific program. Well, what do they mean by that? It might be about your heart rate. It might be about your mapping. It might be about how you want to play a game or how you would shop. I mean, there are literally millions of apps. There's been no product as successful as the quote app in all of human history. But the product, the app, is entirely anchored in and made possible by the nature of what the cloud is, which is this invisible infrastructure that behind the scenes has the attributes of sensors connected to people and things and objects, networks, ourselves, communications, whether wired or wireless, and of course in the compute function, which is more than just memory and storing cat videos or photographs, but the analytic function, which is increasingly the so-called and misnamed artificial intelligence, which is trying to be renamed by the practitioners as intelligent automation, but they're not going to succeed. People are stuck with, like the nomenclature.
Could you talk a little bit about, in one part of the book, you talk about how, essentially our phones, our mobile phones, our smartphones have an enormous amount of information. I mean, they're GPS. I mean, they are ankle bracelets that we willingly, carry around with ourselves, but they are so full of sensors, and we already know this. I think the kind of real-time traffic information, when you're driving or mapping, points to this, where everybody gets a little more efficient because you have information, so you're not all trying to, take the same road to the same place. I mean, there can be, if there aren't a lot of roads to a place, there's going to be traffic jams and stuff, but we can kind of route around it, and everything. But the smartphone has so much stuff in it that we're not even really using yet. This seems to be a place where you can kind of paint a picture of how there's going to be a massive productivity gain without really inventing anything new. It's just maximizing or optimizing the stuff that we already literally have in our pocket.
Sure. No, of course, the smartphones, economic power of the volume of smartphones and our willingness to pay very high prices for it, nobody could have imagined.
Now, it's amazing to think, I suspect you are old enough too, like The idea that anybody would pay for television was insane for probably most of my life.
Exactly.
And then, you know, the idea that, you know, there was that liberation, you know, shortly before the Soviet Union fell, when you could buy your own phone for, you know, $10 at Kmart and finally plug it into AT&T's model. But nobody, you know, certainly in 1980 or probably in 2000 would say, millions of people, hundreds of millions of people are going to spend $1,000 on a freaking smartphone.
Not only pay $1,000, but know that and be willing to throw it away, in effect, and buy a new one every few years. So even in economic inflation-adjusted terms, the average in the Western world, the average spend on, we'll call it devices, both the services and whether you buy it outright or internet connectivity, we spend more on that than we do on furnishings, which is a complete sort of flip of that dynamic, right? TVs were expensive, but you bought it once, you kept it for a decade or more. But the phone is a remarkable thing because it the quote phone, how many people use it to phone, or what percentage of the time does the average user use the smartphone as a telephone. We all use it for that as well, but you don't buy it as a telephone. It happens to be a feature, but you're right. It contains remarkable sensors, the most important of which are, you know, the four. It can listen, right? Obviously, it's the acoustics. It's got GPS, which tells you a gross location. It has accelerometers. These are motion detectors in it. And of course, it has a camera. It has an inverse sense of touch. It can vibrate, right? So it's starting to emulate the senses that human beings have, and they're all put there for specific purposes. But they were put there for purposes initially different than what they're being repurposed for. So the motion that you make, the camera, the accelerometer, people know it can count your steps. That was one of the first unintended uses, if you like, of the accelerometer. It was originally put in so the phone would know what orientation it was in, whether it was faced up, faced sideways. But once you put an accelerometer in, which is just a way of detecting motion, and these things used to be, in the days when I did real research and real work, accelerometer was a coffee can size device. You know, it's a gyroscope, basically. Now they're, you know, microchips. We do them with, you know, microscopic silicon devices. Well, you can use that device to do things like detect heart rate, arm motion, we can detect your fall. We can do all kinds of medical diagnostics, not just things like which way am I walking, how many steps do I take. If we combine that with acoustics, with the camera, we can begin to do some very remarkable things of correlating how you're behaving, how you're feeling in terms of your physical animation with whether or not it's predictive. And it turns out it's reasonably predictive about looking at that you might be coming down with something. It may not something different than just falling down, that your tonal quality, your degree of animation, these things tell a computer that's smart, that is a learning algorithm, which again is inference, not calculation. It's not saying, yes, you're sick. It's saying, well, based on all these characteristics of what your Fitbit or your phone is saying about your breathing rate or your walking rate or your hand gesticulation or your tonal audio quality, the probability is that you may be coming down with the flu or the cold or that you have a heart issue. This is really quite remarkable. And the impact of that is still nascent. You know, we're only beginning to have enough data, and that literally only recently, a few years, to begin to have the inference be relatively accurate. It's getting more accurate, literally, by the year or by the hour. But those technologies also bleed out into other things, not just our smartphones. We use the cameras and the accelerometers in automated machines and in our cars. And then as they get cheaper and cheaper, and just the objects of everyday life and the supply chains of all the things that move the goods the world cares about. On all that data, that this is a tsunami of data of unprecedented proportions, is a rich place to go mining. You know, you've heard the expression, you know, data is a new oil, which is interesting economically, a total mischaracterization functionally. But anyway, I mean, data consumes energy, oil produces energy. But that whole penumbra of facts, and the smartphone is a great sort of pivoter on which to explore them. And I, as you know, I do in my book, tells you something really different going on. This is what, you know, again, it'll be obvious in hindsight. It is, it's really different if everybody's connected with a telephone instead of horse and buggy with letters or the Pony Express. Everybody knew that at the time that it was a big deal. And to your point earlier, they weren't all happy about it. People saw the telephone as socially disruptive. It caused people to interrupt conversations and pick up a phone, right? All these kinds of social norms got changed. And it doesn't mean all social norms that were changed were all for the good. I'm not making a value adjustment, but in some cases, social norms changed not for the good. Took a while to react, re-equilibrate, we'll call it social function. And some of the things that are going on now because of the cloud, social media is a cloud function, are not so good. I mean, clearly not so good. We know a lot of things are bad. A lot of things about the automobile were not so good and still are not so good. Accidents are never good things. I mean, we invent things that have high value that also bring with it risks. It's the nature of technology and human nature. So that's a little side rabbit hole, but it's important because when I talk and write about the benefits, if I get criticism, it's, oh, well, you're ignoring the downsides. No, I'm not. I mean, we're inundated with media talking about the downsides to things. We don't have enough analytic focus on what the new upsides are, which again, so what I'm trying to do in this book is to explore what this confluence of technologies, this sort of tsunami of both connectivity and data are doing across all domains. So I look at it in terms of work, as you know, and healthcare, in terms of the productivity economy, in terms of entertainment and education. These things are all being changed. So it's not that the cloud itself is the only feature of the future. It's, again, the infrastructure. The size of this infrastructure, by the way, is really quite remarkable. I mean, let me put it in sort of dollar terms. The world's spending more on the physical infrastructure of the cloud every year than the world is spending collectively on the electric utility infrastructure now. It's really quite a transformation, and the spending on the cloud infrastructure is growing far faster still.
Hey, before we go any further with the recent interview with Mark P. Mills talking about the cloud revolution and why we should join him as being optimists about the future, I want to tell you about the Lions of Liberty podcast. This is one of the oldest, greatest, longest running libertarian anarchist podcast networks in the world. They've got a suite of programs. I've appeared on a bunch of them, and I enjoyed the hell out of it. These guys hold space for libertarians to argue about everything, which is kind of nice, right? On Monday, you get John Odermatt delivering his powerful mix of inspiration, health, and faith to set your mind, body, and soul free on a program called Finding Freedom. Every Wednesday, Brian McWilliams is going to make you laugh at our deeply, obviously broken world, while also providing the promise of a better future with his show, Mean Age Daydream. On Friday, there's a bunch of different shows, Meme Wars, Hate Watch, or their infamous, notorious, very funny Libertarians in Living Rooms Drinking Liquor episodes. So check out as your first step towards freedom, or maybe your mid-step towards freedom, or maybe one of your crowning steps toward freedom, the Lions of Liberty podcast, suite of podcasts. It's a great bunch of shows. You can listen every day, all the time, at Lions of Liberty Network, everywhere podcasts are found, or just check the show notes here and check out the episodes I'm on. They're somewhere in the show notes. Lions of Liberty, you're going to dig it. And now back to Mark P. Mills talking about the roaring 2020s that are happening all around us already. So we have this, you know, superabundance of cloud computing. We have all of these different kinds of technologies that are coming online that you describe, you know, in all their varieties in your book about the cloud. Why is there such an intensely negative, pessimistic feeling about technology? And it seems certainly in the political class, it seems in a cultural sense, we are riven with anxiety. What's your guess for what's going on there? You have a podcast called The Last Optimist. Yeah. You know, why are there so few of you?
And you know, this is where I get to migrate from the domains of physics to the domains of psychology. Mm-hmm. And so my opinions are all based on experience, not on my observations of when I meet and talk to people. Yeah, it's human nature, first of all. Let's just be clear that negative news is clickbait, is negative news. It's been true for most of history, certainly the entire history, modern history of the news media. So it's not new information for me to say disasters and things that shock people, outrage porn, all this stuff, are what drives eyeballs or interest. And that's what drives fiction and drama. I mean, dystopian science fiction is the staple. Drama where there's murders are a staple, and dysfunction in dystopia are we always, yeah, that's, it's what human beings seem to be drawn to for interest's sake. And it, so I think there's two things going on. That's amplified in again, by the negative side of the cloud, is that we haven't sort of figured out operational behavioral filters, if you like, the amplifying negative news that the way social media and information in general is disseminated. In a weird way, the 1920s, go back to where we started, that we were closer to that then than we were 20, 30 years ago. Today, we're closer to the 1920s on information dissemination that's negative, that's made up, that's fake news, to use a modern term. It was called yellow journalism then. People forgotten or didn't know that there were more than 20,000 newspapers in the United States and early 1920s, many of them published three times a day. So the velocity of demand for news was as great then. The news cycle, people, it's faster now. No, it's faster now than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It's not faster than it was a century ago because there wasn't enough news to fill out many newspapers. They competed by literally making stories up. You read the history of journalism. The yellow journalism began then because of cheap technology, the technology that made pulp paper possible, cheap distribution, the car, the rail lines. So we flooded the world with newspapers, which were filled with fake news. And most of the fake news was salacious. It was about disasters. It was about murders. Anyway, we had an interregnum where that wasn't going on, I guess, 40 years ago. It is back again. I think people don't like it by and large. They feed on it. I think we've jumped the shark, to use that modern expression. Yeah. So I think it ends.
Which has already entered and passed out of the common lexicon.
Yeah.
That was a web 1.0 phrase.
Exactly. Yeah. So these things have cycles. They're not predictable cycles like 60 cycles that happen every 60 minutes, 60 hours, 60 days. But they have cycles. So I don't think culturally we're going to tolerate, see evidence of it because of the bipartisan move to, quote, legislate things and regulate things. I'm not proposing that's a good thing. Sometimes it is a good thing. It echoes a reaction. What will usually happen is governments step in to do something that's already being fixed by sort of common behavior in a way.
And a shorthand version of that might be, you know, just as conservative or, you know, Republican and Democratic leaders are talking about breaking up Microsoft. That's the past panic. Meta. People are kind of evacuating Meta.
Yeah, they are. Exactly. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Your ageism showing up like mine, remembering the great debates that Microsoft was a monopoly, had to be broken up. Well, it turns out others competed.
Microsoft controlled the access to the internet.
Exactly.
Or, you know, to the pre-cloud. And somehow the only thing that stood in the way was, muscular antitrust action.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to Microsoft's own, you know, inability to kind of pivot to
We can wind the clock back to the 80s and IBM had 60% market share in computing, and there were antitrust concerns. We had steel antitrust, we had rail antitrust, we had car antitrust. So there are abuses of power in corporations, just like there are in governments. But that doesn't mean that the solution is the system sort of solves itself often, as you know, because scale has a disadvantage as well as to an advantage. You don't innovate as well as scale. The innovators eat your lunch. This is what happened to Microsoft. They're one of the few that recovered. Other companies did, like Wang back in the day in digital equipment and Time Warner and all the rest. But anyway, back to the dystopian. So that's in human nature. It doesn't mean it's like that old adage, you know, the you're paranoid, but the bullets might be real. It's just there's probably fewer bullets than you realize. And the guy's running out of ammunition. I mean, there is a reason for some anxiety about what's going on. There are disruptions that are uncomfortable and discommode people. I get that. But at the same time, human beings are pretty flexible at expressing their opinions about what they don't like. So I think that's going on. I think we're going to see it legislatively, behaviorally. We're going to see a lot of disruption in social media, abandonment.
What are the policies that you worry about most? Not just, you know, stupid ones, but you at the beginning, you were talking about how policy matters, politics matter.
Yeah.
You know, what's the cloud equivalent of Smoot-Hawley tariffs or burning our boats?
Well, I think would fall in three simple buckets. Deciding that we're going to regulate the cloud, broadly speaking, that there any regulatory impulses tend to lock in yesterday's technology and make it difficult for innovation. So people famously look in more recent history at the regulation of the telephone industry, which everyone figured out finally that it was stifling innovation by giving the monopoly to Ma Bell. You suppress the ability for literally the internet or cell phones to come into existence. So the monopoly got broken up finally. Rail monopolies got overregulation of rail is another famous example in history. So I worry about overregulating, heavy-handed approach to fixing some of the problems, if you like, governments can't help themselves trying to fix. So I worry about that. I think we run the risk of stifling the cloud's opportunities by deciding that it's a natural monopoly that's not changing, and we're gonna fix it. The government. The other thing I worry about, of course, is the government's instincts to decide what innovation is and where to direct money, which ties to the government's instincts to take money from markets, from businesses and people, to direct it to businesses and people they think are going to solve problems the government deems are the ones that should be solved. And of course, you know, the electorate participates in this loop by getting overexcited about an issue, whether it's social media problems or the, you know, energy challenge, if you like, the climate change issues. So government's instinct to decide what's innovation or where to push money or suppress opportunity to innovate by overregulating or by overstimulating things that are not innovative. I mean, so if I were giving it as a specific example, the trillions of dollars that are being squandered senselessly on energy, quote, innovation, I've used air quotes for that, are inflationary and destructive, not because the markets can't survive it. I think America will survive it. That's where I come in as the last optimist, if you like. Mm-hmm. We are squandering, and we're going to squander trillions of dollars. I'm not naive about this.
What's an example of squandering? What's a subsidy or a policy or a regulation right now that you think is misdirecting money
an easy one because it's a technology company, Tesla. I admire Elon Musk enormously because of what he's accomplished in the hardware space, which very few entrepreneurs take on. They take on software. He does both, but he's done something that subsidies can't explain away. You can't explain his success on the basis of subsidies. Rich people aren't stupid. They don't buy $90,000 cars because you give them $10,000 off. Has to be a good car. So nobody successfully built a new car company in a century. Good on him, right? But the government has decided that the electric car is the only option for future driving and is subsidizing the hell out of it. Well, okay. If it's the inevitable future, if it's the equivalent of going from horse and buggy to car, which it's not, but let's just say if it were, you not only don't need subsidies, you should get out of the way because the stampede of people making the transition will be impossible to stop. So we're going to, and we are spending billions, hundreds of billions of dollars and directly, and hundreds of billions more by virtue of mandates, which have a hidden and very real cost to economies to accomplish something that if it were real would happen anyway and robs the economy of that capital and inflates the cost of the of collateral goods, which is never good. Inflation's really bad.
You talk in the book, you mentioned that Tesla essentially emerged 100 years after Studebaker ended the last kind of commercial production of electric cars. Yeah. There's an interesting irony there. You also, both in the book and in more recent writings at the Manhattan Institute, has an archive of your work, as well as links to your Last Optimist podcast. You talk about how electric vehicles have certain benefits, but they also have different costs. They're right. not environmentally free. It's just that the costs show up elsewhere.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that and how that gets into this larger question, both of optimism, because, you know, you're constantly talking about how things are getting better. You know, new technologies are being developed that are just incredibly good, but also we live in this world where we think we can just kind of legislate the proper answer for the future. And yeah. and it seems a lot of times we don't understand that, you know, what is seen and what is unseen when we're doing that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And of course, the challenge we have politically is that people want perfect outcomes. It's sort of wired in, again, another piece of human nature. We want to think we're smart enough to make a good decision. So the government, we allocate to the government, the bureaucrats and policymakers. We do this voluntarily, of course, in many cases. The decision-making, they're going to be wrong at least as often as the private market by definition, because they're not geniuses, they're not perfect. In fact, I would argue they're going to be wrong more often because they're less often as bright or risk-taking as the private market. So mistakes will be made fewer in the private markets. So that's sort of my instinct. It's not a libertarian instinct, but it's a conservative instinct that the private mistakes will happen, but I would rather not be with, I'd rather have it with my money. I want to make the mistake. Don't have the government imposing it on me. But setting that aside, I think the thing about the electric car that's both encouraging and discouraging, it's a misdirection of enthusiasm, in a sense. The electric car is, to put it in analogous terms, it would be the equivalent in 1920 where somebody came along and said, I found a better way to feed a horse and to make the horse live longer and, you know, not you know, excrete unpleasant things on the roads. And I've just invented better food for a horse. It's a magical new food for the horse, but it's still a horse. Still a horse and buggy. Meanwhile, somebody's invented a car. The car is really different than a horse. Feeding a car today a different food, electrons, batteries versus gasoline, it's still a car. Didn't change it. It's still a car. It's not a revolution in the same way it got from horse to car. So that's But the battery itself, the lithium battery, is a really remarkable invention. I write about it in my book. It's a huge deal. It does make possible useful electric cars. There's going to be lots more electric cars in the world, which people will buy voluntarily. And there'll be primarily luxury options or specialty options. There's huge markets for that. There's markets for hundreds of millions of those. But all cars are not going to be electric, and it won't change the world economically. It just won't, because it's not an economically different product. It's the same product. With new different features. And one of the features is that it causes pollution elsewhere. It causes different kind of pollution elsewhere. Oil is consumed in the big machines to mine the metals to make the batteries. And the quantities of metals that are needed to make batteries is so large, so poorly understood, that it is the, if you like, the Achilles heel of electric car taking over everything. You know, a simplistic example would be that one car's battery weighs a half ton to replace 80 pounds of gasoline. That's a lot of, it takes 500,000 pounds of materials mined to make that one car battery. And the world mining will have to increase by a level that's never before been achieved in human history to achieve the kinds of electric car penetration that are imagined by policymakers, politicians. And it's, I would just say it's simply not going to happen. But the lithium battery, it's so valuable. It's not only unleashed the internet to be in your pocket with your smartphone, it's making and going to make possible lots of other things that are untethered, not least of which is the revolution in small drones and aircraft that are autonomous or semi-autonomous, and maybe most critical of which, the underplayed piece and a big part of my book we haven't talked about is the real robot, the untethered robot. Robots as assistants to humans in industry are in fact maybe the biggest sleeper revolution that is sort of obvious, hidden in plain sight, that's been hyped and then discarded as being hype. And now it's in the discarded bucket of, and yet it's probably the single most interesting and important economic invention of the early 21st century. And here's the irony. Elon Musk knows that and believes that as well. He, as you know, famously or infamously unveiled his new robot that they plan to make and has bragged that he says, his words, I'm paraphrasing, it may be Tesla's most important product. And I agree. He's right.
But we haven't heard a lot about it.
No.
In a while, right?
Yeah. You can't buy one yet. That's one of the reasons.
The and you stress in the book and elsewhere that automation, I mean, this, again, you know, this is a step change. It's different when we have autonomous, semi-autonomous robots, untethered robots. But in the broader scheme of things, automation does not mean the end of work. It does not, it is not a dystopian moment. It's actually, if past this prologue, it will be an emancipatory, a liberatory right. development.
Well, human beings have been trying to automate stuff since all of history. I mean, the history of automation is fascinating, and I put a little bit of it in some of the history of my book. I found a quote, a really delicious quote from something written by a Roman centurion at the time of the Roman Empire, where his engineer had figured out a more efficient way, an automated way to bring the stones in to build his palace. And the potentate, the Roman potentate said, well, this will put my slaves out of work. What will I do with them? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but nothing has changed. Automation, the purpose of automation is, of course, to reduce labor and inputs to get an output. So you get more output for less labor. And the precious resource in human history has always been human labor, human time. And we always want to pay the labor more because we're the labor. If we want to pay the labor more, I have to have less of it to get the same output, not make the output cost more. Hence, automation. It's emancipatory, as you say. It does displace work. It's supposed to, but it creates more wealth and then more network over time. In the short term, it does mean that there are dislocations in labor markets. So one of the things we've done in recent history is try to figure out socially responsible, to use the modern jargon, ways of handling that, whether it's unemployment insurance, facilitating new training. It doesn't mean there aren't dislocations, right? But And they're not comfortable dislocations for those affected. I know that. But the trope that robots, automation will eliminate work and people won't have anything to do, it's not only wrong, it's exactly backwards. All of history shows exactly the inverse. The thing that the cloud does is it not only automates inference and advice and amplifies sort of advice-giving functions, so it's another form of invisible robot in the cloud. But it also enables the physical robot because the cloud provides the utility computing function to allow untethered robots to do their job because it's really hard to emulate what people do when we're untethered and walking around. We need it to do both. Both are emancipatory. And because both are happening simultaneously, that's why I'm profoundly optimistic about its economic impact over the coming century. And it begins in the 20s. We sort of stalled out the unleashing by policies of lockdowns. The lockdown was the classic black swan event, which took 2+ years of fuel out of the growth of the world, fecklessly, needlessly, in my view. But that whether you think it was needed or not is irrelevant. It happened. And so I think we reignite. But we'll reignite in a weird way. We'll be of accelerated as people try to reacclimate to a growth again. They're going to be searching for naturally new tools, and the new tools that are available in forms of automation and AI are really quite powerful. And so we're going to accelerate growth. That's what I think happens.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Mark P. Mills, the author most recently of The Cloud Revolution: How the Convergence of New Technologies Will Unleash the Next Economic Boom and a roaring 2020s, and the host of the Last Optimist podcast. Mark, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it very much.
This has been the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcast and sign up there. Thanks for listening.